Pitt, which is 11 SA 12, Riddle and others versus Hickenlooper and others. Both parties ready? Let me just mention briefly to both parties, the appellant will have to take, is responsible for your own time. Yeah, it's a 30 minutes per side. And when you start your argument, please tell us your name and who you represent. With that, attorneys for the plaintiffs.
May it please the court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Leanne Morrill, and I represent defendants Governor John Hickenlooper and Secretary of State Scott Gessler. Plaintiffs sued my clients in federal court, alleging that state officials incorrectly interpreted and applied state law, and alternatively, that if state officials correctly interpreted and applied state law, that Colorado's constitutionally established contribution limits violate their First and 14th Amendments. Plaintiffs sought preliminary injunctive relief. After a hearing that occurred in September of last year, the federal district court denied that request for relief, specifically finding that plaintiffs were unlikely to succeed on the merits of their federal claims. Thereafter, the parties agreed that plaintiffs' first claim regarding state officials' interpretation and application of state law may be dispositive or at the very least informative of the federal court's decision of plaintiffs' federal claims. As a result, the parties jointly moved to certify the question to the Supreme Court here. There are two questions of state law encompassed by the certified question before this court. The first is whether the contribution limits established in Section 3 of Article 28 of the Colorado Constitution apply on a per-election basis or on a per-cycle basis. The second question of state law for this court to address is if the contribution limits apply on a per-election basis, as the state contends, are sections 1-45-103.7, 3 and 4 consistent with the Colorado Constitution? Turning first to the question of whether Colorado's contribution limits are meant to be imposed on a per-election basis, defendants urge this court to find that the plain language of the Constitution dictates that limits are imposed on a per-election basis. The basis for this finding would be the use of the word or in the Constitution, which states that candidate committees may accept and individual donors and political committees may make contributions up to certain amounts for a primary or a general election.
Counsel, can I just get you to elaborate on that? I mean, from what you've said so far in your briefing, it suggests that you're putting brackets around this is a primary election, this is a general election, correct? I mean, you're kind of cordoning those off with the or. And I'm wondering how that fits with your statutory interpretation question when the statute actually doesn't make those barriers, similar barriers.
Defendants argue that the Colorado Constitution merely establishes limits that apply on a per-election basis. As you say, the Colorado Constitution brackets contributions based on a primary election or on a general election. That's all the Colorado Constitution seeks to achieve.
Right, but the whole idea behind that is we're cordoning off this and this. And what the statute does is, oh, you can give money for the primary, but you know what? If you spend it in the general, that's fine. or vice versa. I mean, there's no bracketing in the statute. So can you help me understand why there's bracketing in the Constitution but not in the statute and how those can be consistent?
Yes. First, because the Constitution only seeks to limit both the amount of contributions and the occasion that triggers the right to make or accept those contributions. Whereas the statute seeks to regulate the timing and expenditure of...
Right, but the statute, or I'm sorry, the constitutional provision uses the words primary election. You're reading into that, why can't you read that? Everything you have to do with regard to the primary election has to be done during the primary election, based on your constitutional argument.
Because to read otherwise would require this court to read language into the text of the Constitution that is simply not there. Specifically, instead of where it says for a primary or a general election, this court would have to find the meaning of that phrase to encompass for use in a primary or general election. All the word for connotes is what occasion must occur in order for a candidate committee to accept contributions and in order for an individual to make those contributions.
Right, but how can you give a contribution to someone for a primary and then they get to spend it in the general? That's the part I'm not understanding.
That's a question that goes to whether or not the statute is closely drawn to achieve the constitutional mandate, which is that limits are on a per election basis. But without reading language into the Constitution that simply is not there, this court may view the constitutional limits as simply the voters intending to both reduce the amount of contributions and to indicate that the ability to make or accept is contingent upon whether the candidate participates or their name appears on a primary.
That's the part I don't understand that. How do you get that out of the language of the constitutional provision? That the voters understood that they were making that cabining. Is that just returning to your or? That they really wanted to make a sharp division between the primary and the general in terms of contribution limits, but they didn't care how the money was made or spent.
The voters intended, by passing Amendment 27 and adopting language in Article 28, to recognize that there are distinctions among candidates based on whether or not they participate in a primary election or if they bypass the primary process in Colorado and head straight to the general election ballot. And that distinction is what triggers the for a primary or a general election limitation. There is no evidence either in the 2002 voter blue book or the actual text of the constitutional provision that suggests that Colorado voters intended to regulate the timing and the expenditure of contributions. To just simply give an example, you can give me money for my birthday. I don't have to spend it on my birthday. And I think that is all the word for in the Constitution designates, is what occurrence or occasion must happen for an individual to make or a candidate committee to accept money.
Could I ask a question on that way over at this end? If it's not sufficiently implicit in the language that if it's donated for something, it has to be spent for that, is there any reason to think money donated, contributions given during one election cycle can't be used in a different election cycle or for a different candidate? Or what is the limitation on what they can be used for then?
There is no express limitation in the Colorado Constitution. The statutes may fill in where the voters did not legislate through the constitutional amendment. And in the case of campaign contributions in Colorado, the ability of incumbents to carry over money from one election cycle to the next, which in fact Plaintiff Curry was able to do, illustrates that is one example where the legislature has acted to say what you can do with money received in one cycle if it's not expended in that same cycle.
And with regard to moving to a different cycle, I guess you're more familiar with these provisions than I am, but down at 3E, they then make specific provision for carrying over unexpended funds to the next cycle. But they place specific limitations on what you have to do with that. I'm not sure how you read that, but on its face, it would seem to say they have to be treated as contributions for that next cycle. But there's no provision like that in terms of carrying over money from a primary to a general.
No.
How do you understand that usage?
Yes, Justice Coates, I agree with you. The Constitution specifically says for unexpended campaign contributions to be carried over to a new election cycle, they must be both reported and counted as party contributions and subject to the limitation on amounts for party contributions. By contrast, the contribution limits at issue in this case do not fill in the gaps, so to speak, in terms of when contributions may be received and how they may be expended or for what purpose they may be expended. And in that gap provided by the Constitution, the legislature has seen fit to step in and provide guidance for candidates, their committees, and for donors.
And does that sort of, then just one follow-up, so you're reading the failure of the Constitution to address the question of carryover from a primary to a general, where they had addressed the carryover from one cycle to another, should be meant as expansive or flexible, that the legislature can decide then how that can be done, rather than intending that it not be able to be done at all?
That's correct. That is the state's argument, that in the gap, the legislature may act, and that when it acts, it is subject to a rational basis review by this court, and its statutes are entitled to a presumption of constitutionality that must be rebutted beyond a reasonable doubt. And here, plaintiffs have not met that standard. Because the Constitution does not tell candidates when they may receive contributions or how they may use those contributions, the legislature has done so. And that interpretation is entitled to deference from this court. Returning to plaintiff's initial claim, which is that this court should hold that Colorado's contribution limits apply on a per-election cycle basis, defendants urge this court to reject that interpretation or construction for three reasons. First, that it would, in effect, have the total amount of contributions that candidates such as Plaintiff Curry and others similarly situated to her would be able to receive under the Colorado Constitution. So where if this court were to read for a primary or a general election as for a primary and a general election, it would have the result of reducing the current 200 and 200 for a total of 400 if the candidate participates in both primary and general elections to $200 for the entire election cycle.
Well, that's right. That's what happens under your interpretation. Isn't that correct? No?
No, Justice Hobbs, that's plaintiff's interpretation of how this court should read the Colorado Constitution. They urge this court to change the word or to the word and, which would result in a reading that Colorado's contribution limits apply on a per cycle basis instead of on a per election basis. The absurdity in that result under the law is that it would have the existing contribution limits.
Well, why is that an absurdity? Then, that's the part I don't understand of that argument. Why would that be absurd? Why is it absurd to hold everybody to the same aggregate amount?
Absurdity in the point of constitutional amendment construction results when this court's reading would render some of the language or provisions of the Constitution obsolete or contradictory or nonsensical. That's what I mean by the use of the word absurdity. I think, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but I think your question goes more to the fairness issue of why is it fair?
Well, I guess I'm just trying to figure out if that's just duplicative of your earlier argument that or separates in brackets, or if there's some other provision that's rendered superfluous, or that's the part I was missing.
Okay. The language in the Constitution that's rendered superfluous is the part that indicates that aggregate contributions up to $200 for a primary are acceptable, and contributions up to $200 for a general election are acceptable. If the limits apply on a per cycle basis, meaning we conflate the whole process, that halves the total contribution amounts from $400 potentially if you participate in both elections to only $200. And that's a result that courts generally strive to avoid in terms of construing constitutional amendments as well as statutes. Additionally, our argument is consistent. Just as we urge this court not to add language such as for use in a primary or general election, we ask this court to avoid changing existing language, changing the or to an and.
Well, right, but why, this is just back to my initial question, but why when you're giving somebody your $200 for a primary and they take it and they spend it in the general election, why is that? I mean, that doesn't seem to comport either with this language, does it? Because you've given them the $200, which they are now, essentially, they're making your contribution to the primary as a contribution to the general.
That's only one example, factually, of how contributions can play out under the current scheme. An alternative would be the case of an individual who runs, say, from a major party, who runs in the primary process, incurs debt during that process, and then after the primary after the primary accepts a primary election contribution and spends it to retire that debt.
But how do we know that's a primary contribution? That's because it's made during the general. It's just if you write on the check, this is for the primary.
To answer your question, we don't know under Colorado law. There is no requirement that donors designate their contributions.
And that gets back to the initial point is how can you put so much weight on the use of the word primary or general?
Because it's really more of an emphasis on the use of the word for and or, not
okay.
Well, you were about to, I think, answer this question of fundamental fairness, though. And I'd like you to go down that line, if you wouldn't mind, and let me suggest that the question in my mind is, why does it really make a difference whether somebody has a primary election? If they're, and this, we're coming back at it from the same angle, but if someone was able to use the money for both a primary or a general, or to retire a primary debt after a general has started, isn't it all just money necessary for an election cycle?
The defendants would respectfully disagree with that assessment, and the reason for that is because there are real distinct differences between those candidates who access the ballot in Colorado via the primary process versus those that skip the primary process and head straight to the general election. So, by way of example, with respect to the plaintiff, Ms. Curry, in 2010, she ran as an unaffiliated write-in candidate. For her, accessing the ballot in Colorado simply involved filing an affidavit of intent with the Colorado Secretary of State. Her deadline for doing that was 70 days prior to the general election. She filed that affidavit on July 28, 2010, shortly before the primary election occurred. By contrast, major party candidates and some minor party candidates as well go through the primary process in Colorado, which has two components. There are precinct caucuses. Precinct caucuses are typically held in March, but in the year of the general election. At those caucuses, delegates are elected for the party. Delegates then proceed and attend general assemblies in our county general assemblies. At the county general assemblies, the delegates vote on the potential field of candidates from which they would like to see one candidate, or potentially up to three, be selected as their party's designee for the primary ballot.
Well, are you suggesting that this primary process is very expensive for the candidate? Is that where you're going?
That is exactly what I'm
saying. Okay, and then, so let's just stipulate to that. But what if the person is an incumbent and has no opponent at all?
Well, in the case of candidate Curry, she was an incumbent.
Right, I'm just saying, as a distinction, the person is a party incumbent and has no opponents.
And even in the case of, well, it depends what this court means by no opponent. The facts that played out before the federal court in the preliminary injunction process established that that candidates who participate in their party's primary process, trying to gain their party's nomination, are attempting to clear the field, which means they are trying to discourage other candidates from throwing their hats in the ring. Plaintiff Curry did not have to do that. By definition, unaffiliated candidates do not have intra-party competition. She had no field to clear in her route to the general election.
I understand. I guess my question is why does it really matter how much candidate A versus candidate B, candidate C spends in getting to the general ballot, as long as money that you collect during the, quote, primary season can be used in the general election season?
Do I understand you correctly? Is the court understanding that it's unfair to allow?
I'm not certain. I would never speak on behalf of the court, trust me. But my question is, why in the world would it make a difference? Say candidate A says is in a primary, she's going to get her $200, spend it only entirely on the general election. Candidate B is not in a primary election, going to get $200, spend it only on the general election, right? Candidate A doesn't have any other expenses for primary election, is only going to get to spend it on the general election, but she gets twice that amount. She gets $400.
Candidate A does face expenses.
Well, maybe A does, maybe A doesn't. But does it really make a difference? Because the expenditure of those funds isn't tied to expenses. It's like if you say you're going to go to a primary, you get to collect extra money, even if you don't have to spend it then.
But oftentimes candidates don't know that they will be uncontested in a primary race until shortly before, so they can't operate under the assumption that they will be uncontested at the primary.
Sure, I understand that there are lots and lots of different variables, but why is the denominator, why is the keystone whether or not somebody is in a primary election as opposed to whether it's costing somebody some money to make their way onto the general ballot, irrespective of how they do it?
For fairness reasons, the candidate who participates in a primary process and a general election is not alike to a candidate who only participates in the general election process. That is why the district court...
I missed the very first part. I'm sorry.
The candidates are not similarly situated. Candidates A and candidates B are not the same. Therefore, the law does not have to treat them the same. And in Colorado, the voters have recognized that candidates who participate in two elections before for prevailing, as opposed to those that only participate in one, should be eligible to receive more money. I'd like to reserve the rest
actually,
of my time.
Actually, I just have a follow-up question, because you haven't answered this part of your argument, which is, I guess you're saying the constitutionality of this setup is entirely irrelevant. Isn't that the position you take in the brief, that this situation could be entirely unconstitutional and it wouldn't affect our analysis?
What I believe the brief argues is that this court lacks jurisdiction to consider the underlying federal claims. But I do believe that this court could determine that the statute may not be consistent with the Colorado Constitution, but the Colorado Constitution, the limits in the Constitution still apply, and they still apply on a per election basis. For the reasons that I've stated, the statute is consistent with the Constitution, but is that answering your question?
Yeah, that's fine. Thank
okay.
you.
Thank you. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
You may.
May it please the court, William Zimski of Abedy and Schill, Durango, Colorado, on behalf of the plaintiffs, Joelle Riddle, Gary Hausler, Kathleen Curry, and the committee to elect Kathleen Curry. I'm going to dispense with my introductory remarks that I prepared. I might circle back to them. But I just want to get to the real meat of this. Let's accept the interpretation proffered by the state, i.e. that that Section 3 has a $200 limit for primary elections if you participate in those primary elections, and $200 for the general election if you participate in the general election. Given their interpretation, the court should answer the question certified to it in the negative, because if you look at Title I, Article 45, Section 103.7, paragraph sub 3 and 4, it allows a candidate to receive general election contributions before the primary and spend those contributions before the primary. That is totally contrary to the interpretation just accorded the constitutional provision by the state. Because according to the state, you have to participate in the general election in order to get general election contributions. But the way the statute is written is you can get general election contributions even if you don't participate in the general election. You may never even get to the general election. But the way the state has interpreted the statute, the way they've interpreted the constitutional provision, the statute allows candidates to receive general election money before they are eligible to participate in the general election and to spend that money on the primary election. And if you go to the words in Section 3, it's for the primary election or, it doesn't say for, but generally, for the limits are for the primary election or the general election. So, but what the statute, it turns out it's on its head. It is just as Eve has suggested in her questioning, there's compartmentalization between primary and general in the constitutional provision, but all that compartmentalization is dissolved in the statutory provision. And this is, this is just politics. I mean, the Republicans and the Democrats got together and they said, okay, how can we do this so it benefits us? It hurts minor parties, it hurts independent candidates, and they devised this system.
Well, would you back up and give us your best reading, please, of the constitutional provision?
Okay, my reading of the Constitution is consistent with how the Federal Election Commission has interpreted similar language in the federal election law. Now, I think in my brief, I had cited to the McCain-Feingold Act.
Rather than making that analogous argument, could you just respond to Justice Hobbs and give us the interpretation consistent with the language? In other words, walk through the language in the Colorado Constitution and tell us what you think it means.
Okay, I think the language of Section 3 means that the candidate shall No person shall make to a candidate committee, and no candidate committee shall accept from any person aggregate contributions for a primary or a general election in excess of the following amounts. So there's no word in there that says you have to participate in a primary election. There's no word to say you have to be on a primary election ballot. Because if you're a minor party candidate, you don't face an opponent, you go directly to the general election. If you're a major candidate and you're facing, you don't face a primary opponent, you're on the primary election ballot, and bingo, you get to get the primary election a contribution per the state's interpretation. Per my interpretation, getting to the question, I apologize, is that any person who is a candidate is allowed to get $200 for the primary election, $200 for the primary, and $200 for the general. So even if you're not facing a primary election, even if your name is not...
Okay, I understand that result that yeah. you're saying it ultimately means, but walk me through the language and tell me how you get that out of this language.
Well, I get there the same way, I suppose, the Federal Election Commission gets there.
Well, don't give me that argument.
Okay.
Walk me through this language.
Okay, it says for a primary or a general election. So if you can get $200, if you're running as a minor party candidate, unopposed, why? There's a primary election. There's going to be a primary election for all candidates. As of the day, like August 10th or whatever, how many days before the general election? I forget what the statute is, 70 days before the general election. That money can be contributed to a candidate or a candidate committee, no matter whether he's participating in the or she's participating in the primary election or not.
All right, let me try this approach. Okay. The state says that the interpretation I think that you're working with right now uses the word or in the conjunctive instead of the disjunctive. Isn't that true?
No, that's not true. I would contest that. I would say that there is no language in this statute, in the constitutional provision, that says that you have to participate in the primary or have your name on the primary election ballot in order to qualify for those funds. And there's nothing.
So if you're right in, you can get a total of 400.
Yes.
Okay.
But can I just add, just to clarify here then? So you are agreeing with the state's interpretation to the extent that you believe money contributed for a primary can be spent on either the primary or the general, and money contributed for a general can be spent on either the primary or the general. You don't believe it has to be spent on the election for which it was contributed.
Yes, if you read, and that's under my interpretation. But if you read under their interpretation, they say the contribution, you have an aggregate for the primary and an aggregate for the general. And if you don't participate in the primary, you're not entitled to get those contributions. But so they're going a step further, and they're saying, "Well, hey, you participated in the primary, but now we're going to give you general election money to spend on the primary, and we're going to give you primary money after the primary is over to spend on the general." So if there's a compartmentalization, if there's this for a primary or a general election, if there's the compartmentalization, then the statute's inconsistent with the with that compartmentalization. So that's what I'm saying. I'm saying that the way that this is kind of general language, I believe it's ambiguous, but it's susceptible to two reasonable interpretations, the state's interpretation and my interpretation. And I hate to bring it up, but it's consistent with the Federal Election Commission interpretation of similar language. Therefore, I think it's eminently reasonable interpretation. That what you've got to do is you've got to allow somebody who's not facing a primary is to pick a date. And that would, if the state had interpreted it like that and instituted a statutory regime similar to what the Federal Election Commission did, there wouldn't be any question about it. Okay? That would be, and what the Federal Election Commission allowed is that allowed somebody who's not participating in the primary to pick a date where they have a cutoff.
Could I ask one follow-up
yes.
here then? So you're basically arguing you should be entitled to $400 even if you don't have a primary, and the same as they're arguing those who do have a primary or at least or here in a primary would get. Let me say, though, is it a reasonable construction of this language if one were to read the for language to implicitly mean language has to be contributions have to be expended on the election for which they were made? That would, I take it, result in the situation in which you would only, your clients would only get $200, but those who participate in a primary could get $400, but could only spend $200 on the general election. Do you see a constitutional problem with that?
Yes, I do, because I believe, and in my briefing, any interpretation of a statute or a constitutional, even a citizen voted initiative, if there's two reasonable interpretations, if it's ambiguous, I think the court has to make sure that it comport the interpretation which you adopt comports with the federal constitution. And in Davis versus the FEC, the U.S. Supreme Court said they have never upheld the constitutionality of any law in which people running for the same office are allowed to get different amounts of contributions from individuals. And so if you interpret it such that Ms. Curry or a libertarian candidate or a regular independent candidate who's on the ballot cannot receive the same as somebody they're running against, you're bumping against the First and 14th Amendment. And as explained in my brief, there's no basis to say, and the only constitutional basis for limiting contributions that the Supreme Court has held is to prevent corruption or the appearance of corruption. Now, the fact that it may cost more money to run the cost of a primary is not a legitimate reason to limit contributions.
Mr. Semsky, isn't that an appropriate argument for federal courts?
As this court held in Citizens Alliance versus Davidson, one of the considerations in the background is how the court's interpretation of the statute would be. It didn't address the federal constitutional issue, but that was in the background. I'm not here arguing that you should declare Section 3 of Article 28 to be unconstitutional. Rather, I'm asking for you to interpret it so it comports with the federal constitution, an interpretation that is consistent with how the Federal Election Commission interpreted similar language, and an interpretation which necessarily leads the court to answer in the negative to the question certified to it. Because the statutory implementation of Section 3 of Amendment 28 clearly obliterates any type of distinction between primary and general election contributions. For instance, you can get money, like I said, they say you have to participate in the election to be qualified to get the money, but under the statute, you can get general election money for a primary, and conversely, if the money's for the general election, if the $200 is truly for the general election, how can the statute be consistent with that when it allows for a $400 contribution well after the primary? I mean, if you want to limit corruption, the appearance of corruption, if I'm a contributor, I'm going to wait and see who wins the primary, then I'm going to give them $400. Conversely, maybe they have a contested primary and they win the primary, it's a walk because it's a Democratic, controlled district. I'm going to give them $400 for the primary. It's still the same $400. You still, and the only legitimate interest is to prevent corruption or the appearance of corruption. How can limiting a contribution to Ms. Curry for $200, how can that prevent corruption, but her opponent can get $400 from a different person or the same person? It just doesn't make sense. That's why it's unconstitutional.
But is that still true if the statute is inconsistent with the Constitution, but is inconsistent for the reason that it allows expenditures of contributions for one election to be used on another?
It solves the problem partially. We'll see what the General Assembly does, what kind of law they pass, but then we might be back in the same, in the same boat. So I think, with the background of the federal constitutional issues out there, I think in order to to answer the certified question, I think the court has to come out with, okay, this is how we interpret Section 3. And you can interpret it the way the state does. And if you do, then it's obvious that the statutory implementation is inconsistent with...
Is there a way to read the constitutional language and say that the cap is really 200? We're not talking about 400 at all. I mean, if you participate in both, you still only get an aggregate contribution of 200, right? For a primary or general election, in excess of the following amounts, and then go down to B, which is what we're talking about, right? The state...
For $200.
No, it's 200. So the total is 200. You can spend it where you want to.
I believe that that would be an interpretation that would, I think, solve all the problems.
Well, I mean,
it's an unreasonable interpretation, and it's one that would comport with the constitutional issues that we've raised.
Well, if you assume the voters want an equal playing field for the candidates that come out of this process, it is possible to read that saying as, you know, either or both, the aggregate is 200 as specified for House candidates. Total.
And that's an interpretation that I think that would be fair. It would be constitutional because it would put everybody on the playing surface. It would accomplish the goal of the Amendment 27, which was to limit money influence in the government, you know, in politics. I mean, that's the in the constitutional, the Supreme Court's you know bedrock interest is to prevent corruption and the appearance of corruption. That would work, and but you can't have a system where, you know, just because, and the way that the legislature has written these statutes is, okay, if you're a libertarian candidate, you don't get opposed, you go straight to the general election ballot. So why should he get $200 where the major party guy who's an incumbent, no one's run against him, in the last, two election cycles, he gets $400. I mean, how is that constitutional? How can you have different contribution limits for different candidates who are running against each other? And the cost of a primary election can never be a consideration, or the cost of an election can never be a consideration when you're having campaign contribution limits. Because otherwise, you can make the argument, well, hey, nobody knows who I am, so I'm going to have to spend a lot more money to get my name out there. I should be able to get more, from individuals than other people. And, hey, I'm running against an incumbent. It's going to cost me more because he has all this built-in name recognition, so I should be able to receive, accept money, a higher contribution. You get in a situation where, you can't make that as a consideration in limiting contributions. In politics, in elections, that's one of our primary, fundamental rights is to have fair elections and people to participate in those elections on a fair and unbiased manner. What the General Assembly has done here, and they did pass this before Representative Curry did take office, was something that is just unfair to everybody except Democrats and Republicans. And 33% of the registered electorate in Colorado approximately are independents. 89% of all major party primaries are uncontested. So you've got a system that is totally skewed in favor of the major party candidates, and which impinges upon First Amendment rights of people who want to contribute, who want to make their voice heard, even if they don't have a chance, even if it's a libertarian candidate. He wants to get his idea out there, and I think that's really important in the electoral process. It's not just about winning and losing. It's also about the expression of political ideas. And I think that's really, and if you limit a contribution to half the amount, you're limiting speech and without any purpose. And basically what you're saying is, you can buy off a libertarian for $200, but, a Republican, $400 is the limit. It just doesn't make any sense. And going back to the state's interpretation, about in the way that the statute, plays, if you receive primary election money after the primary election and spend it for the general election, that money isn't for the primary election, as required by Section 3 per their interpretation of the Colorado Constitution. So at the very least, the statute is inconsistent with the reading that the state ascribes to it. The interpretation that we propose, and I guess Justice Hobbs has now proposed, either of those interpretations would comport with the federal constitution. And you're not, again, I'm not asking you to say that this, you know, the voters did something unconstitutional by voting for this, but I think it's a bedrock principle that when they do vote for something, you know, they don't want to vote for something that's unconstitutional. They assume that, you know, what they're voting for will be interpreted to be constitutional.
Counsel, can I get you to, I know Justice Martinez stopped you, but can I get you to expand on the similarities between the language that we have in our constitutional provision and that in the federal act?
Okay.
And, I mean, how similar is it?
Okay,
to get you over the hump.
Yes, in my brief, I cited the McCain-Feingold, but the legislative history and the regulatory history is much older. The Federal Election Campaign Act of 1971, Public Law 92-225, that was when they first started to, you know, deal in this. But that's where they, you know, defined elections to be primary, general, runoff, special elections. And then in the amendment of 1974, Public Law 93-443, that's when they adopted the per, you know, $1,000 at that time limitation with, in a quote, with respect to any election.
Right, so the language actually isn't the same. I mean, you're saying similar, but...
It's similar, but they say, I think the federal language is, they say, with respect to any election.
But they don't, the federal language doesn't use the words primary and general,
but it says,
or general.
Well, it says general, it says any election, but then it defines election at 2 U.S.C. section 431 to be a general, primary, runoff, or special. And then they have caucuses, and then they have some other election, you know, things that they have. So the elections, in the federal law, the elections are the same. Now, so in Public Law 93-443 in 1974, they Section 310 of that law created the Federal Election Commission. It took them 6 years to come up and publish in the Federal Register on March 7, 1980, 47 FR 15094, the rules that I cited to, which are consistent with how we interpret the language. So in other words, they got the federal statute and they said, okay, you're limited to $1,000 with respect to any election. And then they looked and said, oh, how about when somebody doesn't, you know, isn't subject to a primary ballot, either they get, you know, you could be a major party candidate in some states, and if you're not opposed in the primary, you go straight to the general election. Independent candidates, those people don't go on primary ballots. So what the Federal Election Commission said, okay, if you don't go on a primary ballot, you have to pick a date, you know, and the date is usually like the date of the regular primary election for the major party, and that's your primary election. And other regulations, they get specific and they say, okay, you can only use primary election for primary election contributions for primary elections. You can accept primary election campaign contributions after the primary election, but only to repay debt incurred in the primary election.
Right. So they do kind of have the bracketed approach.
They segregate it, but there is a carryover. If you raise $10 million in the primary, you know, and you spend $5 million, you have $5 million in the bank and you can go forward with that. But you can't get the general election contribution under federal law and spend it on the primary. You know, that's our argument. That's why the statute is inconsistent with the reading ascribed or the interpretation ascribed to the state to Section 3. Because if they say there's a compartmentalization between general and primary elections, how can you have a statute that says, oh, don't worry about that compartmentalization, you can get your general election money before the primary and spend it on the primary. Or, you know, wait till the primary is over and take your primary and don't even get a contribution for somebody until you're on the general election ballot and then get primary election contributions? How does that make sense? You know, it just doesn't. It's even if you accept their interpretation, the statute is inconsistent.
Well, it seems the state wants to add additional language here, in excess of the following amounts for each election. I mean, if you just read literally the language, aggregate contributions for a primary or a general election excess of the following amounts go down to B, $200 to any one candidate. Right?
I agree. I mean, I
so isn't that the end of the question? That's the literal language of the Constitution. So there's a cap of $200 that any one person or committee can give to a candidate. It doesn't say each election. It doesn't say 200 each election, does it?
I think I'll let the state answer, but I think they're going to say, well, for a primary or a general. So they're going to say the or word is offered.
It says aggregate, though, and then it says in excess of, and then you look at in excess of, it says $200. Well, okay. I agree
with your analysis. I mean, I think that's a reasonable interpretation of this language. Again, I mean, there's a third interpretation, that can be, So I definitely believe that this language is ambiguous. And lots of constitutional provisions are, you got to fill them in, but you can't argue that there's compartmentalization and you have to participate in the primary election and then say, well, the statute is consistent with that, but it allows you to take general election money and spend it on a primary election.
Do we want to assume that the voters knew that there could be write-in candidates and therefore this aggregate would apply or not? I mean, does that play?
Well, I believe the electorate is assumed to know the state of the law when they vote for a constitutional amendment or a statutory amendment by initiative. They're responsible or assumed to know that libertarian candidates might go, or minor party candidates unopposed might go directly to the general election. I don't think there's any reading at all that the voters wanted to have some sort of two-tiered system that favors Republicans, major party candidates.
If we move to the position, which I thought you were willing to accept there, that there's at least an ambiguity in the use of the word or here. And if you look at some of the things we've written in the past about that word or, it seems like it might be hard to say there could be no ambiguity. But that being the case, do you find the state's argument about the blue book at all persuasive in resolving what the correct interpretation of that ambiguity should be?
Well, I don't think the blue book really addressed it. It just had a table in there and it just said, general election, primary election, general election, old system, new system. The old system was a general election cycle in the new system. And in their interpretation, I think pages 18 and 19 of the reply brief, they say, well, there's no, Section 3 is utterly silent about the timing and the purpose. I mean, if it's utterly silent about the timing and the purpose, that means you've conflated, it's not per election contribution limits, you've actually conflated them into a per election cycle. And if it's a per election cycle, it's totally unfair to have, major party candidates getting twice as much as minor party or independent candidates. So that's...
Can I stop you there just to follow up on the blue book? I mean, just tell me what you interpret the blue book to mean. I know you're saying it's kind of irrelevant, but can you help me understand what your interpretation of that would be?
Well, the blue book, they had the table.
Right.
And it's proposed and present. And the proposed was, general, primary and general. And this would, I guess, probably go against Justice Hobbs' interpretation because it does have a breakdown between primary and general. But nowhere does it say that, you have to, participate or be listed on primary ballot.
Well, I guess another way of looking at that is that did the blue book just not anticipate someone who did not participate in a primary?
I believe that I would assume that, and these are partisan issues where, Republicans and Democrats may differ, but if there's anything bipartisan about, politics, it's, let's give the short end of the stick to the Libertarians and the Greens and the Independents. I mean, there's where some bipartisanship occurs, and it's occurred here. So, much to the detriment of anybody supporting that point of view. That wants to get a political ideology and be able to contribute money to have that expressed in the public forum of an election. So,
Just remind us again, this blue book, the Legislative Council prepares that. They generally try to balance the arguments pro and con. Do they actually speak for legislative intent of the proponents of the proposal?
There's a for and against where they have, yeah. They summarize the public comments.
Right.
Depending on the thing, they may publish all the fors and against. Sometimes they don't get that many, from my understanding. Secretary of State's office, I'm sure, knows that a lot better than I do. But I think it's supposed to be, they're supposed to do a balanced approach of how it should be interpreted, but then they summarize the fors and against. the comments that we received from the public or you know, in writing in the Blue Book.
What do our cases say about what kind of deference we give to the Blue Book?
I think it falls below, you know, the plain language of the, you know, obviously the plain meaning can be discerned, and I think other statutory construction aids, such as I've suggested that you've got to balance, you've got to make sure that it doesn't, that it comports with federal, you know, constitutional issues. I think that's more persuasive than anything in the Blue Book. And I think the court has also ruled that you don't look at the proponents, what the proponents said during the course of, I think, with the Douglas Bruce and Tabor, I think that's come up on a number of occasions where I believe, and I could be wrong, I believe that if Douglas Bruce said something about it, it's not necessarily relied upon by the court as the intent of Tabor. If you have no other questions, I can.
Thank you, Mr. Do you have something else? You have 32 seconds. Thank you. Ms. Merrill?
Mr. Zimsky urges this court to adopt an interpretation of the Colorado Constitution that would change the word or between primary election and general election to the word and in order to trigger per cycle contribution limits as opposed to per election contribution limits as the state intends. In answer to Justice Coates' questions about whether that would be permissible if the result is that all candidates, regardless of affiliation, are allowed to accept aggregate contributions up to $200 for the entire election cycle, which would be the result under Mr. Zimsky's reading of the Constitution. His answer to your question, Justice Coates, was yes, that would be permissible. The defendant's answer to that question is that interpretation would be immediately struck down by the federal court on First Amendment grounds, as it was in the case of Randall v. Sorrell. Vermont's contribution limits in that case were $200 per election cycle. And the Supreme Court found that amount was impermissibly low to allow candidates to mount effective campaigns for office.
But $400 is sufficient.
Yes, and in this case, there is substantial evidence that candidates such as Ms. Curry
But she only gets the $200 that you've just told us is unconstitutional?
No, I'm sorry. Okay. It's only unconstitutional if it's $200 for the entire election cycle, meaning it's $200 for those candidates that participate in both a primary election and a general election. And the evidence of why $200 for an unaffiliated write-in candidate like Ms. Curry or a minor political party candidate who goes straight from their convention process to the general election ballot is evident in the last election. In the 2010 general election, Ms. Curry came within just over 1% of defeating her opponents, members of the Republican and Democratic Party. She was able to not only out-raise them in terms of fundraising subject to the $200 limit for the general election, but she was also able to outspend them. Additionally, another example would be the American Constitution Party in the general election in 2010. That party candidate for the office of governor for the state of Colorado, Tom Tancredo and Pat Miller, they gathered 36.38% of the total votes in that election, even though they did not appear in a contested primary, meaning that they were subject to only $200 in fundraising for the general election. So I would urge this court, under no circumstances should it adopt a $200 per election cycle limit. Now, turning to Mr. Zimsky's argument about Davis v. the Federal Election Commission, that case concerned the Millionaires Amendment. And what it did is it changed the contribution limit that applies to candidates who were not self-funded, meaning not millionaires, if they were opposed by a millionaire. And it raised their contribution limits for that particular election, meaning the primary or the general. And the court said, we have never upheld the constitutionality of a law that imposes different contribution limits for candidates who are competing against each other. And that is the language that destroys Ms. Racinski's argument, because candidate Curry was not competing against her opponents until the general election. She's subject to the same limit of $200 in the general election as her opponents were. She was not competing against them in the primary. She doesn't get that $200. Finally,
I don't actually get that, because there are a lot of unopposed candidates in primaries. Right?
And but that question that's in your mind, Justice Hobbs, is a highly fact-intensive question.
I understand.
And at the federal level, we presented evidence that candidates who are unopposed in their primary contests still spend significant amounts of money to clear the field, to be the only party nominee on the primary ballot, and that the majority of those expenditures are not for the greater general purpose of the general election.
I'm sorry, Ms. Merrill, your time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you. I was remiss in not mentioning that Justice Marquez will not participate in this case. So the court, I want to thank both attorneys for your presentations and your arguments in the briefs. The matter will be submitted on the briefs, and we'll be in recess until tomorrow at 9:00.